Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's March 4th. This is going to be our last lecture on neurophysiology, which means we're going to have a test over three chapters. The three chapters are enzymes, respiration, and neurophysiology. So not four chapters like it says in the syllabus, but those three chapters. And I'm not even sure I know what the numbers are, but it's neurophys is seven, enzymes is... Yeah, it's four, and then respiration is five. So four, five, and seven. And we could have it Monday, and I suppose we could have it even Wednesday. Now, you could say Wednesday, that might give you an extra day to study. I don't know if that's going to mean much, but you got to study a lot over the weekend. You know, if we push it off till Wednesday and you start studying Monday night or Tuesday sometime, that's way... No, you wouldn't do that. Very good. That's the good, of course not, absolutely not. That would not be the way to do it. Okay, so what are you going to do to prepare for the exam?
Study guide.
The study guide, study guide, study guide, right? And maybe you could listen to the lectures again, but make sure you can answer all the questions in the study guide. But really test yourself when you look at those questions, right? Just don't read the question and read the correct answer. But maybe have somebody read the question to you and the answer so you don't know what the correct answer is when you read it. But if you look at a piece of paper that has the correct answer marked as you're looking over the answers, that's not going to help you out very much. So you really got to work those questions like a test. And if you don't get the right answer, then you got to go back to the lecture or the PowerPoints or the textbook and find out why you're selecting the wrong answer, and that will help you on the test. All right, so... Again, you just can't memorize the order of the answers on those questions because somehow they change when I type it in to the test. It just happens that way, okay? So, and then the exam figures, and I'm sure that everybody in here could get 100% on the exam figures if you practice labeling them 10 times, right? The first time through, it might take you a long time. It might take you an hour or 2 hours. The second time through, be less than half that. And the third time through, you'll be really fast. So practice labeling the figures so that you can label all of them in like 5 minutes, and then what's the test going to be like? It'll be like a piece of cake, right? So that just is some practice with that. Okay. All right, so as far as the tests go, I'm sorry? Yeah, let's talk about the test date. So the test date before we move on to lecture. Okay. Well, raise your hand if you need to have it on Monday. Okay. Okay, so we'll have it on Wednesday, but that also means, though, that we have to have a lecture on Monday over new material that's not going to be on the test. Unless, do you want me to put that on the test, too?
No.
Okay, which is autonomic nervous system. That can be a little complicated as well, so we'll put that on the next test. So it's still going to be over 4, 5, and 7.
The next test can have chapter 9.
So the third test will have autonomic nervous system, which will be chapter 9. Okay? All right, so you probably have plenty to do over the weekend. All right, last time we were kind of finishing up with synaptic transmission, and there are a number of synapses that you have to be familiar with that are exam figures. But remember, there are two general... What is a synapse again? It's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, right? So I could ask you, what's the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
You'd say cell, all right? So here's another one, the structural and functional unit of communication between cells, or how cells excite each other or somehow pass information on, is the synapse, right? And there are two general kinds of synapses. What are the two general kinds? Okay, I'm not sure anybody is... Electrical and chemical, I like, right? So what kind of membrane structure do you need for electrical, to make it an electrical synapse?
Gap junction,
right? So a sodium current can go directly from one cell to the next, and when sodium enters a cell through a gap junction, what happens to the postsynaptic cell? Okay, why is that? Because it... I like what you said, but why do you say that's excitation? Why is it stimulatory? Because sodium, when it enters a cell, does what to the cell?
It depolarizes
the cell, right? So gap junctions cause cells to depolarize their neighbors, and then those neighbors depolarize their neighbors, and that information gets passed from one cell to the other. Okay, but a chemical synapse, we don't have direct electrical contact between cells via gap junctions. What carries information across the synaptic cleft? A neurotransmitter, which is a chemical, right, a signaling molecule. And then, of course, you should be aware of what causes the release of neurotransmitter from the presynaptic neuron. Yeah, because there are voltage-gated calcium channels, so when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, that opens up the calcium channels, calcium enters the cell, and through various mechanisms, that causes the fusion of the vesicle membrane with the postsynaptic membrane, and that releases neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And as the frequency of action potentials reaching the axon terminus increases, what can you tell me about the amount of neurotransmitter that's released? Is it directly related or inversely related or what? I would say directly related. As the frequency of action potentials increase, more neurotransmitter is released, and that produces what? Graded potentials on the postsynaptic membrane. And
within the cell body prior to the axon.
Yeah, or on a dendrite, yeah. And if those graded potentials reach threshold by the time it reaches a certain part of the neuron, that will cause what to happen?
Depolarization.
Yeah, that will cause, well, a graded potential could be depolarization. But if a graded potential reaches threshold, that means that it is causing depolarization. What will happen in a certain part of the cell if it's a... But graded potentials don't have a refractory period. What kind of electrical activity has a refractory period? Close. Action potential has refractory period, not graded potential. All right, so these graded potentials, when they reach the axon hillock, have to reach threshold, and when they do, what happens? That's where you have, this is what I was trying to get at, then you have an action potential, right?
So depolarization is an action potential.
Depolarization is only when you have the membrane potential moving from a negative number to less negative or positive. That's depolarization.
Can you say the action potentials are within the cell body?
Nope.
So it's only...
Okay, where do we have action potentials? Only where?
Only
axons. Now, why do you only have action potentials on axons? Okay, because they're a voltage-gated event. And what allows a neuron to have a voltage-gated event? It's poor terminology, but it has to have what? A voltage-gated channel. What part of a neuron has voltage-gated channels?
Axons.
Only axons. So only axons can have action potentials because that's the only place on a neuron that has voltage-gated channels. Nerve cell bodies and dendrites have graded potentials, not action potentials. And why do they have graded potentials instead of action potentials? Because it has to do with channels again in the membrane at those locations. What kind of channels are there? Close. But ligand-gated channels. In every case, there's going to be something that opens a channel or closes a channel. Dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels. That means they need a signaling molecule to open them up. But on an axon, they don't need a ligand to bind with a receptor channel. They need what? A change in membrane voltage to open those channels up. So that's why that hand drawing that I gave you is really important to figure that one out too. Okay. All right, so here is a nice flow diagram of synaptic transmission. And the signaling molecule that enters the synaptic terminal, don't forget, is calcium. Right, and we talked about the importance of calcium. If you were going to choose calcium in your bones or in your extracellular space, where would you choose to have the proper level of calcium? Yeah, inside neurons or in your tissue fluids, not necessarily your bones, because you wouldn't have any way for neurons to communicate with each other. So you'd basically be brain dead without proper calcium levels. All right, what else do we see on this slide? I think that's pretty much about it. But besides EPSPs, what else can be stimulated with a ligand-gated channel. A ligand-gated channel could also produce a IPSP, right? If it causes, what, hyperpolarization. What ion and motion of that ion would you invoke to explain hyperpolarization?
Chloride
channel? Chloride going in or potassium going out. They go in opposite directions because chloride ion and potassium have what? Opposite charges, so they have to move in opposite directions. All right, so I think this is where we left off last time. Okay, so that kind of takes us up to speed. One important neurotransmitter, as a matter of fact, you can't say it's the most important, but this is the most prevalent. This is one that's used in most systems in the body. This is acetylcholine. It's used in the brain, it's used in the autonomic nervous system, which is part of the peripheral nervous system, and is used at all neuromuscular junctions. So neuromuscular junction is a synapse, and what kind of synapse is it? Is it electrical or chemical? It's how can you convince me it's a chemical synapse? Because? Okay, well, because acetylcholine is a chemical. Okay, so therefore, a neuromuscular junction is a chemical synapse, right? Okay. All right. So all neuromuscular junctions, that's the junction or the synapse between motor neurons and skeletal muscle cells. All right, so that's how skeletal muscles are stimulated. Acetylcholine receptors have two major subtypes to them. One type is called a nicotinic, and another type is called muscarinic, and that's because there are naturally occurring compounds that plants produce that kind of mimic the shape of acetylcholine. So how would you explain the binding of acetylcholine to a receptor based on what kind of characteristic of acetylcholine molecule? Would it be the color? Or the electrical charge, you would say shape, right? So the shape has to be complementary to the receptor, right? Well, nicotine and another compound called muscarine have similar shape to acetylcholine, so they can bind to different acetylcholine receptors. And we know that there are these two general subtypes, a nicotinic and muscarinic. And these can be either excitatory or inhibitory. They can produce EPSPs or IPSPs, and we're going to look at some circumstances of when that happens. All right, but in any case, they're always a ligand-gated channel. They have to bind acetylcholine. This kind of ligand-gated channel contains both a neurotransmitter receptor site as well as an ion channel. All right, so, and they open when a ligand binds to the receptor. So here is a nice illustration, which is an exam figure, of a nicotinic-type acetylcholine channel. All right, so this is a membrane protein. It goes all the way across the membrane and is made up of a number of subunits, five different subunits that come together. And on two of the subunits, there is a binding site for acetylcholine. So for this particular kind of receptor channel, two molecules of acetylcholine have to bind in order to change the conformation enough so that this channel becomes patent and then ions can flow through it. All right, and the ion that mostly moves through this one is a sodium ion. All right, so when acetylcholine binds to this nicotinic type receptor, sodium enters the cell, and what can you tell me about that process? Is it depolarizing, and is that stimulatory or inhibitory? I mean, is it excitatory? Yeah, it's excitatory, right? It causes depolarization, brings the membrane potential to threshold, and that might trigger an action potential by the time it reaches what part of the neuron? The axon hillock, the trigger zone, right? The trigger zone. Okay. And we looked at, we didn't look at that. All right, so when sodium enters the cell right here, that causes a graded potential. Right, so the graded potential happens on nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And since it's excitatory, then we call that what? An excitatory postsynaptic potential when sodium enters a cell. Okay, and when there is no acetylcholine bound to these receptor sites, this channel is closed. So it can flip back and forth. So this is a typical nicotinic type receptor channel. All right, there's another kind. What's the second kind that we talked about? Or just actually put it on the list up there. Besides the nicotinic, there is the muscarinic type receptor. All right, and the neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel. They are different. They're independent proteins in the membrane. All right, so the receptor is a one subunit transmembrane polypeptide, and you kind of know what the shape of it looks like already because you had to know that for the first test. All right, and when the G protein dissociates, it can bump into a second protein in the membrane, which is the channel. So, and when it does, that can activate the ion channel indirectly through what those dissociated G proteins. And this is a nice illustration that shows that. Okay, so here is the receptor molecule. Right, notice it does not have a channel, but it has an active site or a binding site right here that can bind acetylcholine. And how would you describe the binding of acetylcholine to the receptor right here? You would say, what kind of model would you have in your mind? Maybe like the lock and key model, right? The shape of the active site has to match up the shape of acetylcholine, and muscarin has about the right kind of shape to fit into the active site and activate this particular protein. And what it does, it activates these G proteins, causes them to dissociate, and they float around inside the membrane, and they can bump into a second protein, which is a potassium channel. All right? And when they bump into this potassium channel, they can cause it to change conformation, and it opens up, and guess what potassium does? Potassium leaves the cell, and what is that called? When it leaves the cell, it's diffusing. What happens to the membrane potential? Okay, does it get more negative or less negative? Yeah, it gets more negative. What do we call it when something gets more negative? That's hyperpolarization. Now, is that an EPSP or an IPSP? That produces an IPSP. So when this potassium channel opens up as a result of acetylcholine binding right here, that inhibits the cell. Right here, and we're going to see a couple important organs where that happens, where that's important. All right, so for nicotinic channel, it is what? It's excitatory, produces EPSPs, but in this example of a muscarinic receptor, it produces an IPSP. Okay. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Is muscarinic
always IPSP? Not always. A nicotinic is always an EPSP. But we can find some examples of muscarinic receptors that produce excitatory postsynaptic potentials. Okay, but this might be the most important one for you to remember, the IPSP. Okay. Okay. All right, now, when acetylcholine is released from the presynaptic neuron, its action has to be terminated, right? It should have a very short life within the synapse. So what allows that to happen? Okay. Yes, acetylcholinesterase, or ACHE, breaks down acetylcholine. So when acetylcholine is released from the presynaptic neuron into this synaptic cleft, right, it can bind to this receptor, but we don't want it to bind to this receptor forever and ever. We want just a short duration of action. Because, well, for instance, if this was a nicotinic channel and you released acetylcholine into the neuromuscular junction and acetylcholine never went away, what would happen to that skeletal muscle? It would be contracted, right, for the rest of your life. Well, that wouldn't work, right? So every chemical synapse, right, you need to get rid of the neurotransmitter so that there's short duration of action. In the postsynaptic membrane, there is inserted enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine into acetate and choline. I don't think you know what choline looks like, but you know what acetate looks like. What can you tell me about acetate? Two carbon. Yeah, it's just a two-carbon fragment. Kind of looks like acetic acid or acetyl-CoA, right? It's just that two-carbon fragment. All right, and then since it's broken down, it no longer has the right shape to bind to the receptor, and then the action of that neurotransmitter is what? Is terminated, is stopped. Okay, so that's important to know how acetylcholine is broken down, or the effects for synaptic transmission are terminated, and that's by acetylcholinesterase. All right, other kinds of neurotransmitters. Oh, I got a few more things to say about acetylcholine. In the peripheral nervous system, the neurons that use acetylcholine as a signaling molecule at the synapse are what we call cholinergic neurons, right? As opposed to other kinds of neurons that we're going to talk about. So a cholinergic neuron uses what as a neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. So it kind of matches up. You should be able to, I think, remember that one. Large synapses on skeletal muscle are termed, let's pick this one, neuromuscular junctions. These are huge synapses compared to most synapses between neurons. All right, so that means that since they're big, it releases, the motor neuron releases a lot of acetylcholine. There are a lot of ligand-gated channels on muscles. And so in every particular case, it's going to produce a very large EPSP because a neuromuscular junction has a nicotinic-type receptor. Remember, nicotinic always produces a depolarization, and that produces a large EPSP. We call that an end plate potential. And every time a motor neuron has an action potential at the axon terminus and it releases acetylcholine into the neuromuscular junction, that causes enough voltage-gated channels in the end plate right here to cause an action potential in that muscle, and that muscle will always then contract as a result of that. All right, so anytime a motor neuron releases acetylcholine, right, that's going to result in muscle contraction. So you saw that some neurons, right, can make up their mind whether they're going to trigger an action potential or not, depending on the balance of EPSPs and IPSPs reaching the trigger zone. Right? But a difference with skeletal muscle is that whenever there is any kind of graded potential from a motor neuron, the muscle fiber can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. It just does what? It just contracts. It can't make up its mind not to contract. That's what skeletal muscle is for. Another way of saying that is that skeletal muscle is the only thing in your body that you have direct control over. You can't say, oh, I need to pick up that eraser and erase something, right? Send signals to the muscles to pick up that eraser, and then the muscles say, no, I'm not going to do that, right? What does a muscle do when you think about moving some part of your body? A muscle can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. It always contracts when your brain sends signals to it, okay? Because there are no such things as IPSPs at the neuromuscular junction, and every time acetylcholine is released at a neuromuscular junction, it causes contraction. No two ways about it, right? Except if you are poisoned. And here's a poison that stops that activity, and it's called curare. Curare blocks acetylcholine action at the neuromuscular junction, and that came from a plant, and some insects would eat the plant, and then some frogs would eat the insects, and so the frogs ended up with what? Some curare in them, and they would secrete that curare in their slime that protects them from bacteria and things like that. And there were Aboriginal peoples in South America that somehow found that out, and then they would use curare for their hunting purposes. So they could take little tiny darts, coat them in curare, which came from this little frog, and then when they hunted big game, right, they didn't have to have like cannons and guns and things like that. They only needed these little darts that would carry the curare into a big buffalo or something, and then what would happen to the buffalo that got poisoned with curare? Paralysis, no skeletal muscle function. What's a real important skeletal muscle to have working for you all the time? Like your diaphragm, for instance, right? For breathing. So you can't run very far if you can't breathe, right? So it was a very interesting hunting methodology that they used. So I'm sure they didn't really know much about receptors and active sites and saturation and competition and all that kind of stuff, right? And nicotinic receptors. But nonetheless, now we can explain that very nicely in terms of neurophysiology, how that works. Okay. Other kinds of neurotransmitters we call the monoamine neurotransmitters. And you could maybe tell me a little bit about monoamine neurotransmitters. They have what on them? They have an amino group. As a matter of fact, they have one amino group. All right. And these include serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. These are the monoamine neurotransmitters. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan, norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. We didn't spend a lot of time on these guys, tryptophan and tyrosine. I don't think I've even mentioned it in this class before, but you maybe know something about them. Anybody know anything about tryptophan or tyrosine? Okay, Thanksgiving, because one of these is a high concentration, I guess, in turkeys or something, okay? But these are amino acids. Tryptophan and tyrosine are amino acids. So what can you do with amino acids? What can your body do with amino acids? Yeah, they're the building block of proteins, all right? So you can also see that they're the building block of what? These neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. So what would happen if you don't have tryptophan or tyrosine in your body? There are some proteins that your body can't make. And what else can't your body make? These neurotransmitters, right? So that synaptic transmission that relies on these neurotransmitters will be deficient. Now, these amino acids are kind of special. There are some amino acids that your body can make, and then there are other amino acids that your body cannot make. We call those essential amino acids. Tyrosine and tryptophan are essential amino acids. All right, so if your body can't make them and you need them to stay alive, where do you get them from? Mm-hmm. Yeah, in your diet. You have to have them in your diet. And what is the source of these amino acids? An easy source would be animal protein, okay? Not vegetable proteins. Don't contain both of these, okay? So that's important because you can see that maybe somebody's diet will affect synaptic transmission if you don't have the proper diet. So I think that's an important consideration to be aware of. I'm going to talk some more about that in the next couple slides. Okay. So norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. These are what we call catecholamines as opposed to acetylcholine. Okay, so here is a synapse that uses norepinephrine as the neurotransmitter, right? And so this is kind of similar to what we looked at already, okay? So here we have an action potential coming down the neuron membrane, and it changes the membrane voltage, and it triggers voltage-gated calcium channels to open. And which way does calcium move? Yeah, it moves from outside to inside because it's high concentration on the outside of the cell. The inside of the cell is negative, so calcium enters the cell, and as a result of that, that causes the fusion of synaptic vesicles that contain norepinephrine, the neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter then is released into the synaptic cleft, and it diffuses over to the postsynaptic membrane and binds to this receptor. Now, what kind of receptor does that look like right here? Does that just look like a receptor protein or what? I mean, a receptor channel? No, it doesn't look like a channel. It just looks like a G-protein-coupled receptor. And indeed it is. It's a G-protein-coupled receptor. So when it becomes activated, all right, then, of course, don't forget the G-protein has to bump into a channel someplace and open it up for depolarization or hyperpolarization. All right. Now, what about the effects of norepinephrine? How are the effects of norepinephrine attenuated or terminated in the synaptic cleft? For acetylcholine, it was what? Acetylcholinesterase right within the postsynaptic membrane right here. But there's a different mechanism for norepinephrine. One of the more important is that norepinephrine is then actively taken back up by the cell that secreted it, or the presynaptic neuron. We call that reuptake. So reuptake of most neurotransmitter from the synaptic cleft takes place, and so now it's in the cytosol in the presynaptic neuron, and then it becomes inactivated by an enzyme in the cytosol called monoamine oxidase. That breaks down the neurotransmitter. The reuptake attenuates the effects of this neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic membrane. Okay, and then, of course, maybe the building blocks of norepinephrine can be used to resynthesize it, depending on the purpose of the cell. So don't forget, you've got tyrosine, has to be converted into another compound called DOPA, then dopamine, and then finally norepinephrine. All right, the other way that norepinephrine's action is terminated in the synaptic cleft is by other enzyme called COMT, okay, within the postsynaptic membrane. But I think the only thing that I really want you to know is the reuptake mechanism for norepinephrine. Okay, so I think that's pretty good for this particular. So now let's focus back in on these G-protein coupled receptors right here. All right, so this is a really good exam figure. I don't know if it's on the test or not. But it shows a lot about monoamine activation of cells. So here you have the receptor protein, and it's coupled to a G protein right here, right? So when norepinephrine binds to the receptor, that dissociates the G protein from the receptor, and you could either have a beta-gamma subunit floating around or the alpha subunit. In this case, it's the alpha subunit that's floating around in the membrane, and it bumps not into a channel, but into an enzyme. Okay, so this is another interesting kind of twist on how cell membranes change their electrical activity. And this enzyme is called adenylate cyclase. The job of adenylate cyclase is to convert ATP, which is a high energy molecule, into cyclic AMP. How many phosphates does ATP have? It's got three. How many phosphates does cyclic AMP have? It's only got one. AMP stands for adenosine monophosphate. All right, now is that an expensive process? I would say yeah, because ATP is an important energy molecule, so you're losing an ATP. Remember, glycolysis only makes how many?
Only makes two.
All right, so here you're losing one already, but cyclic AMP is an important signaling molecule inside the cell. All right, and cyclic AMP can convert an inactive protein kinase into an active form. So it turns on, it acts like a switch to turn on protein kinase. And what does protein kinase do? It adds phosphates to other kinds of proteins, and when it adds a phosphate to another kind of protein, what happens to that protein? It changes shape, right? Remember, it's like poking you in the side. You're going to change shape. And if you change the shape of a protein, you change its function as well, right? So when you phosphorylate or dephosphorylate a protein, you can change its function. All right. And the function of this protein kinase, all right, when it phosphorylates other proteins inside the cell, will open up an ion channel. All right, so, and that could be maybe a chloride channel or a sodium channel. So this kind of mechanism could be excitatory or could be inhibitory. All depends on this ion channel right here. Okay, and that depends on the cell. All right, so we have norepinephrine on the outside of the cell. Does norepinephrine ever enter the cell? No, but its effects are felt inside the cell, right? What is the signaling molecule that builds up inside the cell as a result of norepinephrine binding to the receptor right here? It is cyclic AMP. Does cyclic AMP ever leave the cell? No. Okay, and we've talked about this before. Remember, first messenger, second messenger? Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell. So in this system right here that is transducing a signal, the first messenger is norepinephrine. The second messenger is cyclic AMP, because that's always inside the cell. And that changes what the activity inside the cell, the buildup of cyclic AMP. Okay. Now, this is an important mechanism because of the following. When adenylate cyclase, you should probably know that enzyme name and what it does. What does adenylate cyclase do? It catalyzes the production of cyclic AMP. That's an important second messenger inside the cell. All right, so when adenylate cyclase converts ATP to cyclic AMP, what happens to it? Does it get degraded? Does it change? It's an enzyme. Perfect. What does it do? It can catalyze that reaction over again and over again and over again until this alpha unit dissociates from it. Right, but adenylate cyclase doesn't go away, so it can make thousands of cyclic AMPs before it's deactivated. But how many norepinephrines did it require to make those 10,000 or 1,000 cyclic AMPs? Only one. What do you call it when you go from an amplitude of like one signaling molecule to thousands of signaling molecules? That is what we call amplification. signal amplification, right? When you have a little tiny signal and all of a sudden you make it big. So this kind of effect right here is not only just transducing the signal from outside the cell to inside, but it also produces amplification, right? And then when protein kinase gets activated and it phosphorylates a protein, does it get degraded? Does it go away? No, because it's an enzyme. It can catalyze that reaction over and over again. So for every 1,000 cyclic AMP molecules, right, you have thousands of protein kinases that can phosphorylate thousands, many, many more thousands of protein molecules. So you have another level of what? Amplification. So you have a series of steps of amplification. Now you have many thousands of activated proteins inside the cell as a result of just one signaling molecule. So you have a lot of amplification. This kind of mechanism right here that has a number of steps of amplification, we call that a cascade mechanism. All right, that's a cascade. So cascades can amplify a signal, but they can make something happen, what, really, really fast, because the enzymes don't get used up. Here's a sign-in sheet. Okay. So that's the other important thing that you should see, that it's a kind of a complicated looking cascade mechanism, but the purpose of that cascade is what, to make big changes happen really fast inside the cell because of those different steps of amplification that take place. All right, so monoamine neurotransmitters work through what, just a simple ligand gated channel or a G protein coupled? G protein coupled, right, like what we see right here. A muscarinic is also a G protein coupled. It doesn't work necessarily through adenylate cyclase, though. Okay. Yeah.
So, the enzymes don't get deactivated, the channel will still be open.
That's right.
Channel.
Yeah. Yeah. But eventually, cyclic AMP will be broken down. All right, and when cyclic AMP is broken down inside the cell, like for instance when this alpha dissociates from adenylate cyclase and the activity of adenylate cyclase is reversed, cyclic AMP goes away. When cyclic AMP goes away, then that protein kinase becomes inactive and these proteins lose their phosphate and then they're turned off. And when that happens, then this channel right here goes back to its original state. It closes. Okay. All right, who else has a question on this one right here? Okay. All right, serotonin is important because it's involved in regulation of mood, behavior, maybe appetite, and some circulation. LSD has a similar structure to serotonin. So what can LSD do? It can bind to serotonin receptors in the brain and produce all kinds of what? Inappropriate sensations in mood and behavior, appetite. Right, and just perception in general. A deficiency in serotonin pathways are responsible in some cases for producing clinical depression. All right, so one way to potentiate or to enhance the effects of serotonin in patients with clinical depression is to enhance the effects of the normal serotonin that they have being released in the brain. So how could you enhance the effect of serotonin? You can reduce the reuptake, right, in the synapse. And if you block reuptake, what happens to serotonin when it's released from the presynaptic cell? It remains at a high concentration in the synapse, right? And we found that that does relieve clinical depression. Right, so Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox block the reuptake of serotonin, thus prolonging its action and reverses the effects of clinical depression. Okay, dopamine, another neurotransmitter. There are two main kinds of neuronal pathways in the brain that use dopamine. One is the nigral striatal dopamine system that starts in the substantia nigra. Does anybody remember substantia nigra from anatomy? Okay, it's part of the basal nuclei, right, deep inside the brain, basal nuclei, and those are important for controlling motor activity. As a matter of fact, they're important for causing muscles to relax. And the reason why that's important is because, okay, think in terms of an antagonism. What's the antagonistic muscle to the biceps right here? Is the triceps, right? And when the biceps contracts, that produces flexion of the forearm, okay? But when the biceps contracts and produces flexion, what does the triceps have to do? It has to relax and it has to stretch, right? And so it's the basal nuclei that takes care of the triceps here so that when the biceps contracts, you can have a nice fluid motion. If the triceps doesn't relax, what is your motion like? Oh, it's hard. You're fighting yourself. You have very staccatoed kind of motion. You have a loss of equilibrium, okay? And that's characterized by Parkinson's disease. All right, so Parkinson's disease is the loss of this dopaminergic system in the basal nuclei. The other system is the mesolimbic dopamine system. Should we go back to Parkinson's? And brain trauma, for instance, can damage the basal nuclei, getting into an automobile accident, all right? Or what else can? Being a professional boxer, right, getting punched in the head by very powerful people, right, can damage the basal nuclei, right, and produce Parkinson's disease. Sometimes it's just a natural onset of Parkinson's disease. Maybe it could be due to viral infection. Who knows in every particular case. But who is a very famous person that has Parkinson's disease as a result of trauma? And that would be Muhammad Ali. Okay. And when you look at, Muhammad Ali, who did he say? Michael J. Fox. Okay, we could talk about him too for a little bit. Okay, not necessarily due to head trauma. Okay, he didn't experience head trauma, at least as far as he admits or can remember. So since it damages the basal nuclei, I know what I was going to say. What does somebody look like when they have Parkinson's disease? Okay. They kind of look like they're intoxicated. They have tremor, their gait is disturbed, right? They have trouble vocalizing, controlling motor movements. So they kind of look like they're drunk. And you have to be really careful in a clinical setting because when, for instance, if you know somebody is a drug seeker or a drug abuser, those are very difficult patients, right? And you have to always protect yourself because you never know what they're going to do to you for drugs. And so a lot of times people have a tendency to treat drug abusers poorly, but if you treat somebody with Parkinson's disease, like a drug seeker, or treat them poorly, what's that? That would be horrible to do because those people don't deserve that kind of treatment or that kind of attitude from people. So you always have to know why somebody is acting that way and make sure that if they have Parkinson's disease that you treat them with, a lot of respect and not like somebody that's acting inappropriate and drunk in public, right? Don't be fooled by that. Michael J. Fox, another way that you can get Parkinson's disease, is that you can take drugs that affect the dopamine receptors, right? So other kinds of pharmaceutical agents can bind to the dopamine receptors. And back in England, maybe in the 1950s, somebody was modifying heroin and it got out on the street and there were a lot of contaminants in that heroin, and it bound to the basal nuclei of those drug addicts, and it poisoned their motor system to where they couldn't move again after that ever again. So they had normal brain function, they had completely normal cognitive function, but they could no longer move anymore because the dopaminergic system was destroyed as a result of that. It completely paralyzed. Yeah. So that was interesting 60 Minutes episode probably about 30 years ago, which is way before your time, but I'm sure you can find it on the internet someplace. Okay. All right, so this is why drug addicts are kind of interested in the dopamine system, right? Because there's another part to it called the mesolimbic system. It's involved with emotional reward, right? And so a lot of addicts activate this system by taking cocaine activates the mesolimbic system, all right? And so that's a tremendous rush that some people feel, just an incredible emotional reward when they take cocaine. Unfortunately, when you take cocaine, the effects are very fleeting, okay? for minutes, probably not even an hour. So what happens after you feel this intense reward, right, when cocaine, the effects of cocaine wear off, what happens? The opposite effect, right? You have this immense crushing system of, or feeling of what? Of impending doom. So what do you do to block that feeling of impending doom? Well, then you take more cocaine. But how long does it last? Well, just minutes, right? Yeah, not long enough is the answer. All right, so that's really kind of a terrible cycle to get into. All right, overactivity of the mesolimbic system also contributes to schizophrenia. And schizophrenia, actually the addiction can be treated by anti-dopamine drugs. All right, so all these neurotransmitters have interesting effects in the body. Yeah, I forgot how we treat schizophrenia. Ah, okay. Maybe we do treat schizophrenia with anti-dopaminergic drugs, right? So if that poisons if that reduces the activity of the dopaminergic systems. Right, anything that you do then will, one of the side effects would be to produce a Parkinson's-like state. Because it's also involved with the motor system of the basal nuclei. Okay, norepinephrine. That's an important neurotransmitter that's used in the peripheral nervous system as well as central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, we call it the sympathetic neurotransmitter. So how many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? How many divisions? There are two. What are the two divisions? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. The primary neurotransmitter in the sympathetic is norepinephrine. What's the primary neurotransmitter in the parasympathetic nervous system? That is acetylcholine. All right, so that's what we're going to get into in the next chapter, but maybe you recall that from anatomy. Okay. In the central nervous system, the effects of norepinephrine are general arousal, that means producing a wakeful state, and amphetamines stimulate these norepinephrine pathways, right? So that it produces a very aroused state or wakeful state. Now, unlike cocaine, amphetamines have a duration of action of hours and hours and hours, not just minutes and minutes and minutes. What about caffeine? Okay, caffeine, probably related to amphetamine. I can't picture the structure at the moment. Okay, there are three related compounds to caffeine, and all of them produce arousal. All of them might improve mental function. Okay, and all are diuretics, and they're called methylated xanthines. Okay, you don't have to know any of that kind of stuff. But caffeine is not necessarily related very closely to amphetamine, and the actions of those drugs are different in different parts of the body because they can affect the kidney directly, okay, not just the brain. Probably not through norepinephrine receptors, I don't think. I would have to review that. Okay, other kinds of neurotransmitters could be just plain old amino acids. What we saw where amino acids can be used as, or have to be used as precursors to make monoamine neurotransmitters like tyrosine and tryptophan. But here are some that are used as neurotransmitters even without modification. Here's our glutamate and aspartate, or you could say glutamic acid or aspartic acid. These are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. So what do they produce? They produce EPSPs, right? So they bind to a receptor that produces an EPSP. And what can you tell me about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? What is their action? What is their mechanism of action in the body?
Parasympathetic is slow down.
Okay.
Sympathetic is speed up.
Okay. So if I think of this parasympathetic and sympathetic, their effects are what? Opposite to each other. All right, and what do we call that when there's something has they're antagonistic to each other? So antagonism is very important to maintain control and balance in your body. So if you have excitatory neurotransmitters, you should have, in order to maintain balance, inhibitory neurotransmitters. right? So glutamate and aspartate are excitatory. Glycine, on the other hand, is inhibitory. That's very important, right? And it's inhibitory because it opens chloride channels that inhibits, for instance, maybe muscles from contracting. So you can have a nice fluid motion, right? And when those chlorine channels open, that produces hyperpolarization or an IPSP. Strychnine is a kind of chemical that blocks the glycine receptors. So it stops the antagonistic control in your body, so you only produce EPSPs. And that's a really scary kind of thing to see. Without any kind of stimulus, when somebody's poisoned with strychnine, and if there's no stimulus whatsoever, right, they probably will sit and just pretty much act normally. But when they're poisoned with strychnine, any kind of stimulus will cause all of their muscles to contract, okay, because they no longer experience any of that negative control. So somebody could snap their fingers or poke you or slam the car door or something, and your body goes into complete contracture, which means what? Well, you're going to die, right? Because then you can't even breathe. You can't relax the diaphragm. So that's why strychnine is such a terrible kind of poison. And the strongest muscles in your body are what? Flexors or extensors, typically. Usually they are flexors, and that's, you know, how somebody dies with all of their flexors predominating in that kind of contorted state. Another important amino acid neurotransmitter is gamma-aminobutyric acid. We just call that GABA. That's the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it also opens up chlorine channels, right? So that is what? That is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. And when these neurons degenerate, that produces Huntington's disease, which is characterized by, it's kind of like a Parkinson's disease where they can't relax muscles. Okay. All right, the last topic. When did we start? 3 o'clock? Okay. Synaptic integration. Well, we'll have to stay late then. Okay. So EPSPs, you should automatically think, well, is that an action potential or a graded potential? It's a graded potential. It's a graded potential. All right, and because there's a counterpart to an EPSP. What's a counterpart to an EPSP? It's an IPSP. And an IPSP is what? It's a negative EPSP, right? So that's one way to realize that it's a graded potential, because an action potential is always what?
Excitatory.
It's always excitatory. It's always the same height. It's always the same length. It never goes negative, right? So an action potential could never be an EPSP or an IPSP. All right, so EPSPs are graded in magnitude. As a matter of fact, they can even be negative, in which case it would be called an IPSP. They have no threshold, right? An EPSP causes depolarization, just like an IPSP is always going to cause hyperpolarization, depending on what ligand-gated channels are opening up on the cell membrane. And graded potentials, or EPSPs and IPSPs, have no refractory period. So if they have no refractory period, guess what they can do? Okay, they can summate as a result of that. All right, and so what kind of membrane protein is going to produce an EPSP or an IPSP? Is it a voltage-gated channel or a ligand-gated channel? It's going to be a ligand-gated channel. What kind of channel produces action potentials? Voltage-gated channels, right. Okay, then of course don't forget, as a graded potential flows over a dendrite or cell body, what happens to its amplitude? It decreases. It propagates with decrement, as opposed to an action potential, which propagates without decrement. There's no decrement. Okay. So this slide right here just shows the importance of the axon hillock. And so let's just say we're going to stimulate this cell body right here with a stimulus. And this is the stimulus strength, right? So it's going to open an ion channel, and we see a positive deflection right here. So maybe what kind of ion channel is opening right here?
A sodium,
right? Because it's producing an EPSP. And this is going to flow down to the axon hillock. It's going to get a little bit less in amplitude. But when it reaches the axon hillock right here, is it going to produce an action potential? Is it going to trigger an action potential? Okay? And I say no, because it hasn't reached threshold. So this is a sub-threshold stimulus. But let's increase the stimulus by releasing more neurotransmitter. Maybe the frequency of action potentials increases or something. And this produces a second excitatory postsynaptic potential. But it is still what? It is still sub-threshold. And at the axon hillock, it's not going to trigger an action potential. But this one right here reaches threshold, because the threshold is, you know, right about here, minus 55, and that's going to trigger an action potential. So these are what we call EPSPs. So they are what? They're different heights. Action potentials are always the same height. Okay. Well, on a nerve cell body, on a postsynaptic neuron, it's going to have numerous synapses, and it will have numerous synapses from maybe even numerous neurons. And a cell body could have as many as 10,000 synapses from neighboring neurons. Right? I don't know how many cells, but many, many cells. Right? And the trigger zone right here will integrate information up from all, say, 10,000 of those synapses on dendrites and cell bodies. All right, so here we have two cells, number one and number two over here. And let's just say that in this first instance right here, there's release of neurotransmitter only from neuron number one. And what can you tell me about this stimulus right here? It is an EPSP, but what else is it? It's sub-threshold. It didn't trigger an action potential. All right. But now let's say at another time, we have EPSPs produced from both of these neurons pretty much at the same time. All right. So these graded potentials now are going to maybe flow from here and up from over here, and when they reach the axon hillock, what's going to happen? They're going to add together, they're going to summate, and now it reaches threshold, and then this neuron then, of course, decides to trigger an action potential. All right, so spatial summation occurs when two different neurons at two different locations produce sub-threshold graded potentials, but the two sub-threshold graded potentials can reach a threshold potential by the time it reaches the axon hillock. And then that information is, right, passed on down to the axon terminus. So that's an example of spatial summation. Temporal summation occurs because EPSPs that occur closely in time can also summate before they fade away. So if there is a high level of activity from one neuron, okay, it can produce multiple graded potentials. Right, and if that is still at a threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, then that's going to trigger an action potential as well. All right, so that would be temporal summation. And the last topic in this chapter is synaptic inhibition. Okay, so what is that? Well, that's, we said graded potentials can summate. Both IPSPs and EPSPs are graded potentials. So if you add an IPSP together with an EPSP, what happens? They cancel out, right? If they're exactly the same amplitude. Okay, so this is an example of what we call postsynaptic inhibition, right? So GABA and glycine produce IPSPs, and they can dampen EPSPs from other kinds of neurotransmitters. So first, if there is from neuron number one, let's say neuron number one is an inhibitory neuron. It releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell. That's going to produce an IPSP, going to hyperpolarize the membrane, take it farther away from threshold. And if during that time a second neuron, which is excitatory, releases an excitatory neurotransmitter that produces an EPSP, all right, now this EPSP does not have sufficient amplitude to reach the threshold, and so the postsynaptic neuron is going to remain quiet, right? An action potential won't be triggered right here. But if number two were to fire by itself and not neuron number one, this EPSP would be strong enough to produce an action potential. All right, so again, this just demonstrates the integration function of the axon hillock right here that will integrate up not just one EPSP and one IPSP, but what? Thousands all the time. Right here. The last topic is presynaptic inhibition. All right, so let's contrast that with postsynaptic inhibition. Where's the postsynaptic cell right here? Is it number one, number two, or number three? It's number three, right? So iPSPs and EPSPs are going to work in the postsynaptic cell, but we can also have inhibition on a presynaptic cell as well. And that's what we see right here. All right, so this is a different kind of scheme than what you're familiar with. So here is the postsynaptic neuron, and here we see three presynaptic neurons. So here we have a nice axodendritic synapse. Here is a nice axosomatic synapse, because it synapses on the cell body. I said this was an axodendritic because it's synapsing on a dendrite. And then here is an axoaxonic synapse. It actually synapses on an axon of a neighboring neuron, okay? And let's just say that this neuron right here is an inhibitory neuron. So it's going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter, which is going to hyperpolarize the membrane, right? And this is a presynaptic cell. And it can block an action potential from reaching the axon terminus right here. So if this neuron is excitatory, right? This inhibition of the excitatory neuron then is going to block that EPSP from being generated right here. So that's going to produce inhibition on the postsynaptic neuron due to this axoaxonic synapse. Okay, so I think that's it for neurophysiology. Okay. All right, what time do we have? All right, so the test is going to be on Wednesday, 4, 5, and 7. And you have all the study guides. Now, what I don't have for you, but I'll get up there really soon, will be the lecture notes for the next chapter, which is autonomic nervous system. So I'll probably give you a little bit of an introduction today to autonomic nervous system. Okay? I have no idea. Okay, we'll see how that goes. Probably not. All right, does anybody have any questions on neurophysiology? No? Okay. All right, so I'm going to end the show and go on to the next show. All right, so where is... where's that sign-in sheet at? Who's got the sign-in sheet? It's there? Great, thank you. All right, so a lot of this probably is a review from anatomy, and maybe I'm bad for going over it again. I'm not sure, but there are some important things in this chapter that you have to know for sure that you didn't get in anatomy, so I'll just cover everything. All right, so we're going to talk about autonomic nervous system neurons, the divisions of the autonomic nervous system, what kind of neurotransmitters are used, and how they're used to stimulate various organs in your body. All right, autonomic nervous system controls our physiology by regulating what in our bodies? A real easy way of saying that, it regulates everything except what? Skeletal muscle, right? Skeletal muscle is controlled by your somatic nervous system. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, and everything else is what? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And then the only other remaining thing is skeletal muscle, and that's controlled by our somatic nervous system. Okay. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. So muscles can contract on their own without innervation, and maybe you know of an organ that contracts on its own, even if you were to take all the nerve innervation away from it. What would that be? That would be the heart. Yeah, the heart has autorhythmicity. And smooth muscle even has autorhythmicity as well. All right, it can contract in periodic ways. Thank you so much. All right, and smooth muscle becomes more sensitive when autonomic nervous system is cut. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. So I think maybe you can imagine when you control smooth muscles, you have two divisions of the autonomic nervous system going to it. One is sympathetic, one's parasympathetic. All right, so if you destroy the inhibitory effects on that smooth muscle, right, it becomes more irritable as a result of that. And many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active and contract rhythmically. And what the autonomic nervous system does, like on the heart, right, it just increases or decreases that intrinsic activity. Autonomic nervous system increases heart rate or decreases heart rate, but it doesn't really set the heart's internal rhythm. The heart does that pretty much by itself. All right, got my cursor back. Autonomic neurons. In a normal somatic motor pathway, okay, we see a nerve cell body in the gray matter of the spinal cord, right? And this is going to be the ventral horn, and it's going to come out. What is this little pathway right here? This is the ventral root. This is the ventral root, right? And that one axon goes all the way to this effector right here. And what is this effector? What kind of muscle? Skeletal muscle. All right, so it just takes one nerve fiber to go all the way from the central nervous system to this effector organ. And what is the neurotransmitter that's released here in the neuromuscular junction? Acetylcholine. What's the receptor type in skeletal muscle? It's going to be a, and remember the two types are nicotinic and muscarinic, and this one here is always going to be excitatory. That's a nicotinic ligand-gated channel. So when acetylcholine binds, that causes an action potential on this muscle, which causes contraction in every particular case. All right, so this is what we call a somatic motor pathway. Somatic motor as opposed to what? An autonomic pathway. And the second illustration right here illustrates a somatic motor pathway. The nerve cell bodies are not in the ventral horn, but they're in the lateral horn of the gray matter, the spinal cord. It leads, of course, through the ventral root, right? But it does not go all the way to a effector organ, like smooth muscle of the intestine right here. It stops, and you can see it entering into the sympathetic chain ganglia. We're looking at sympathetic outflow right here. Does anybody remember looking at any of this kind of stuff from anatomy? I hope maybe sometime. All right, and so here is a ganglion, which is a group of nerve cell bodies. So here's a synapse. So this is the presynaptic neuron, and this is the postsynaptic neuron. But we also then call it, since this is a ganglion right here, this is the preganglionic fiber, and this is the postganglionic fiber. So there is a synapse here within the ganglion. So how many neurons does it take to carry information from the central nervous system to an effector in the autonomic nervous system?
Two.
It is two. There's only maybe one exception to that rule. But in the somatic motor system, how many is it? Just one. Okay. So I guess I'll tell you, the neurotransmitter that's used in the ganglion right here is always acetylcholine. But the neurotransmitter that's used in the sympathetic nervous system for the postganglionic fiber is norepinephrine. Okay? So in the somatic nervous system right here, this fiber is called a cholinergic fiber because it uses acetylcholine. The preganglionic fiber in the autonomic nervous system is also called cholinergic because it uses acetylcholine. But this postganglionic fiber, since it uses norepinephrine, we can't say cholinergic. It's what we call an adrenergic neuron or an adrenergic system because it uses norepinephrine. All right, so this is a cholinergic fiber. This is an adrenergic fiber because it uses norepinephrine. All right, so don't forget, one versus two neurons. And what kind of pathway is this? Is this afferent or efferent? That would be efferent, yeah, or efferent, right. Okay. All right, divisions of the autonomic nervous system, you know there are two. They usually have antagonistic effects to each other, which is really a good thing. What are the two antagonistic mechanisms in your car that you wouldn't even dream of driving your car without?
Brakes and gas.
Yeah, brakes and gas pedal. I'm not sure if I mentioned that in this class before or not, but that's a good example for you to have in your mind. All right, so these antagonistic mechanisms coordinate physiology. Sympathetic mediates the fight, flight, or stress reactions in your body. The parasympathetic mediates what we call rest and digest, or maybe rest and repose nervous system. All right, so when you go see a movie and pay, how much does it cost to go see a movie these days? Yeah, like $20 for parking, $20 for tickets, so you're talking $40, $50, $60, okay? So if you're going to pay $60 and go see a movie, which nervous system do you want stimulated? Do you want the parasympathetic stimulated, or you want this sympathetic nervous system stimulated? Okay. Well, if it's the parasympathetic nervous system, you're going to fall asleep during the movie. Okay. If it's the sympathetic nervous system, what will be the effects? Your pupils are going to dilate. You'll start perspiring. What happens to your heart rate? It goes up, okay? And perspiration goes up, all right? So, yeah, you'd only actually pay big bucks to get your sympathetic nervous system stimulated, not your parasympathetic nervous system, okay? So we're going to look at some of these effects in this chapter. The sympathetic division has what we call thoracolumbar outflow. Sympathetic stimulation does not leave your central nervous system everywhere. It doesn't leave via cranial nerves. It doesn't leave via cervical nerves, right? It only leaves through certain thoracic and lumbar divisions. And so therefore, we call that thoracolumbar. And so we can see sympathetic nerves leave, and then they enter the sympathetic chain where they synapse, and then the postganglionic fiber takes that sympathetic information to an effector organ someplace. All right, so outflow is only between T1 to L2. So that's probably something that you should have covered in anatomy. Okay, once sympathetic information enters the sympathetic chain ganglia, okay, it can actually move back up or down through the sympathetic chain. So these sympathetic chain fibers sort of act like a little auxiliary spinal cord for what kind of activity? Specifically, only sympathetic activity, which is going to produce what? That fight or flight response. All right, but these are really, really small. All right, I'm not going to ask you about the neuroanatomy, but you probably should know what all these little fibers are called, right? The gray ramus communicantes and the white ramus and the ventral rami. All right, I probably won't test you on that, unless that was an exam figure. All right, the sympathetic division is characterized by a divergence of neurons, right? Signals diverge, but they also come back together and converge again. So the signals spread out, and they come back together again. So when signals spread out, they can activate many, many effector organs, all right? And when they come back together again, that can produce even greater effects on one effector organ. So we call that mass activation because of this divergence and convergence of the circuits. So here is an example of divergence and convergence. All right, so we see here is a sympathetic preganglionic fiber leaving the ventral root, right? And it goes into the spinal nerve right here. And it has to enter the sympathetic chain. And this illustration kind of is wrong because this right here, right, is the gray ramus, and this is the white ramus. This is not an anatomy book, unfortunately. So can you remember that the preganglionic fiber is myelinated and the postganglionic fiber is not myelinated? Okay. All right, so this preganglionic fiber actually enters the sympathetic chain through this second little pathway right here. So this is the white ramus communicantes. All right, but when it enters the sympathetic chain, what do you see happening right here? We see that neuron splitting apart. That's what we call divergence. All right, so it can then re-enter the spinal nerve, or it can ascend, right, or it can descend through the sympathetic chain, or it can even pass from the sympathetic chain, right, to a collateral ganglion someplace through a splanchnic nerve. All right, so that might be ringing a bell for you from anatomy. So the signal splits up and goes into many, many different places. Furthermore, after it splits up, what can it do? It can converge again at this collateral ganglion. And so this produces what? A mass activation of sympathetic effector organs as a result of that. Okay, I don't think this is an exam figure, but this would be a good exam figure for an anatomy class, for instance. Okay, here are the sympathetic chain ganglia, and here are the collateral ganglia, and in every case, a sympathetic outflow tract requires how many neurons to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ? Two. It either has to synapse in the sympathetic chain ganglia, or maybe it passes through and goes to this prevertebral ganglia, or what we call a collateral ganglion. Okay. Okay. An interesting adaptation of the sympathetic nervous system is what we call the sympathoadrenal system. Right? And so sympathetic nerves go to the adrenal medulla, which is located deep inside the adrenal gland, which is on top of the kidney. And the adrenal medulla is a modified collateral ganglion. So in a normal sympathetic outflow pathway, how many neurons does it require? Two, right? The preganglionic and postganglionic. But in this system right here, there's only the preganglionic fiber. The cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber. So when they're stimulated, they release directly into the blood norepinephrine and epinephrine as well. And then these signaling molecules travel where? Everywhere in the body, producing sympathetic effects everywhere that the blood goes, as long as those tissues have epinephrine or norepinephrine receptors in them. Right? And the adrenal gland is stimulated by mass activation. So here is the adrenal gland. A preganglionic fiber comes all the way out and innervates the cells of the adrenal medulla, and those cells then release norepinephrine and epinephrine. And so if you have a signaling molecule like epinephrine and norepinephrine released by the adrenal medulla, would you like to call that a neurotransmitter or a hormone?
Hormone.
A hormone, right? But since they're being released by the cells of the adrenal medulla that are really the postganglionic fibers, it would be better to consider epinephrine and norepinephrine really as neurohormones as a result, because they act partly like a neurotransmitter, but since they're distributed by the blood, they're really a hormone. So the best way to talk about that is that they're actually being neurohormones at that particular circumstance. Okay. So I think that's it for today. When we start up again Monday, all right, we'll start with this one. So Mark 9-17. All right, and then this is the stuff we really have to know in here. Okay, so this is what we're going to talk about. Ah, look at that one. You've seen that one before.